Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today we eat with Mark Twain and get a reminder of what American food has always been. Forget that snobbish nonsense of America having bad food until recently. Twain would say hogwash. He had a voracious appetite and he loved the food of America. He gloried in it, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. He was a locavore of the first order, and if he were writing about food today, he'd be one of our culinary rock stars. Well, stay with us for Twain's take on American food this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and today's show is all about eating in America, past and present, from the very good to the downright nasty. American food of days past comes to us through the one and only Mark Twain. Did you know that he was a wonderful food writer and a passionate locavore? Well, then we've the 21st century side of eating in America, the office refrigerator with your lunch and a whole lot of other things. And of course, 'tis the season when we've got it all. In glorious prime, and so much to choose from, sometimes too much, as in that infamous zucchini glut, we meet one woman who welcomes the squash with open arms and is out to change the world. Well, her world. But there will never, ever be too many perfect tomatoes, which brings me to Anthony Giglio. In the food and wine world, Anthony is famous for his books and tastings and classes. But frankly, today, I really don't care about any of that. I want to talk tomatoes and his annual Pomodorata, Italian for tomato feast, that he holds at his house in Jersey City every year. Anthony, good to finally talk with you.
Thank you, Lynn. So thrilled to be here.
Okay, now, you have got to explain what the Pomodorata is.
Okay, so I was on a press trip in 2001 with a bunch of fellow food writers. Our host was Fred Plotkin, who has written many books on Italy.
Oh, yeah.
I find myself on this press trip for 2 weeks in a minivan all over northern Italy, surrounded by all these very, very well-known writers who are all, you know, talking about what they cook and this and that and the other thing. And I'm the kid from Jersey. And I throw the gauntlet down and say, you know, you guys could talk about food till you're blue in the face, but none of you could cook anything without our tomatoes in the summer. New Jersey tomatoes are the best. And nobody believed me. They all made fun of me. And I said, I will prepare a dinner with 7 courses of tomato-based dishes in August if I can get you all across the Rubicon, which I joke is the Hudson River, and come to Jersey City and see how we roll in Jersey City. And they all came. It was crazy. It was 3 weeks before 9/11, which was a completely different head. We actually talked about it months later. That night will really live on in infamy as one of the greatest times we had before everything changed.
So this is the 10th year. What are you going to be serving?
Well, some things stay the same because they're must-haves, and it's homemade mozzarella from my local Sala Maria down the block, Andrea's. Uh-huh. They make mozzarella every 2 hours all day long, and they make a special monster mozzarella for me that day that I slice very thin and put on a plate with fresh tomato salad, which has nothing but salt, olive oil, and basil.
Sorry, but we've got to just back up here. You live near a place that makes mozzarella every 2 hours?
Yes. When I moved into the neighborhood, I introduced myself and said, I'd love to come see you make mozzarella one morning. How early do I have to be here? And he said, any day you want. We make it every 2 hours.
That's civilization.
Yeah.
Okay, but back to the menu.
So then we start with the tomato salad and big crusty bread. We move into my mother-in-law's eggplant. And this was supposed to be me cooking everything, but my mother-in-law, Lucia, who actually is from Sicily, she makes eggplant, and she calls it eggplant in padella in Sicilian, which means in padella, made in on the stovetop in a sauté pan.
Right.
It's eggplant parm like you've never had. I call it lava. I mean, it is the most amazingly complex, rich, delicious eggplant I've ever had. And when I put it in front of all of these food writers, I heard groans and swoons and some signs of ecstasy. It was incredible.
We will be talking recipes later. You realize this.
Okay.
All right. Moving on. Okay, so what's going to
okay,
be
okay, then we make fresh salsa from, you know, the fresh plum tomatoes. And we serve this with a cheese that I was introduced to by my wife, my Sicilian wife, Antonia. It's called ricotta al forno. And every other region in Italy makes something called like ricotta infornata or some kind of a baked ricotta. But only in the province of Messina, Sicily, can you buy ricotta al forno, which is a 12-pound wheel that after 3 days of blasting in the oven, in and out, in and out, in and out, shrinks to about 6 pounds. And when you cut it open, it's the color of caramel.
Oh, and, my goodness. I've never heard of anything like this.
Yeah, it's very, very hard to find. But in my mother-in-law's town, this is on the table with every pasta course you could put out there except fish. It just melts beautifully, and it tastes crazy good. Crazy, crazy good. And then we move into, it's changed up over the years, but my latest hit for the last few years has been cacciucco, you know, a classic seafood stew done with, again, fresh tomatoes
right. And
fresh chili peppers. And that's followed by, I make homemade ricotta with a tomato marmalade, which I came up with on my own, adding chili pepper, orange rind, lemon rind, and the juice of the lemons.
This sounds fabulous.
So I kind of make a quenelle out of that and scoop it on top of the ricotta. And it makes people sweat and smile. So it's sweet, hot, and creamy all at once.
So now, is that dessert?
No, that's a cheese course.
Oh, that's a cheese course. Excuse me. So what's dessert? What do you do for dessert?
We try and keep it light, and I just make espresso over gelato and call it a night. And then out come cookies and cakes and everything else that people bring, or my mother-in-law happens to make her beautiful pizzelle, which are always a big hit, too.
Well, the night of the pomodorata, I'll be raising a glass to you, and thanks for talking with us, Anthony.
thrilled, and thank you.
Anthony Giglio's annual tomato feast, the Pomodorata, is lamentably a private event. But I've got a tomato jam recipe inspired by Anthony that could start you doing your own feast. Check out Sweet and Piquant Tomato Jam on the website, splendidtable.org. You want to save an endangered species? Eat. Eat at the mom-and-pop places in your backyard and on the road. And forget the chains. They don't need you. Jane and Michael Stern can be your guides with their road food site and their reports here. Jane, Michael, you know, it occurs to me, we have not heard about your own stomping grounds for a long time. Connecticut, you know, the New England.
Well, one of the reasons we live in Connecticut, when people ask us, why do you live here, we say it's for the pizza. And I'm not kidding. I mean, Connecticut really does have perhaps the best pizza on earth. I don't know. I haven't eaten it everywhere. But
do me a favor. Don't tell Chicago. Don't tell New York.
You know. Don't tell Naples.
Exactly.
Well, all right. It may not be VPN approved like the Neapolitan pizza police want it to be, but Zuppardi's Abitz in West Haven, Connecticut, makes some of the most wonderful pizza anywhere, and I mean even including New Haven and its famous pizzerias. This place has been around since the 1930s. It's a storefront in a neighborhood, nothing fancy looking about it, but when you want a fresh clam pizza, it may be the best place to go. And when I say fresh, I mean when you order it, they start shucking the little neck clams.
Wow.
Once the order comes into the kitchen.
Isn't that just wonderful?
That sounds incredible.
Some of the places in Connecticut cheat, and they use not canned clams, but sort of pre-shucked that they get in. But this is old school and in the brick oven and with a razor-thin crust. I mean, it's just a wonderful find.
Well, while we were enjoying this, one of the Zuppardi family came over to us, and And, you know, we were kind of moaning and groaning about how wonderful the clams were. And she said that, you know, she's had vendors come to her over the years trying to offer flash frozen, you know, cryonautic, otherwise pickled clams to substitute for the fresh ones, which are so much work. And she said, frankly, I think even the canned ones are better than those. And if you look at the Zupardi's menu, what's interesting is there is a whole clam pizza, and then for approximately twice the price is the fresh clam pizza. And you'd be an idiot not to get the fresh clam
one. But let me just say something so our listeners do not walk on the wrong side of the Zupardi family.
Okay.
If you get a clam pizza, do not ask for mozz, also known as mozzarella. You don't put mozzarella on a clam pizza. And if you do, you're going to get the out-of-towner evil eye.
Well, you know, according to Italian tradition, cheese never, ever enters your mouth at the same time as fish does.
Yes.
Ah, okay. There you go.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness,
but
Lynn,
but this is what, you know, I don't think a lot of folks who don't live on the coast know what a clam pizza looks like.
They
does it
really
have tomato?
Don't.
You know, is it a white pizza?
Okay.
It's a gilded, it's really basically an olive oil frosted flatbread with freshly opened little tiny little neck clams. I mean, tiny, tiny clams on it. And maybe some spice and then a grating of hard cheese, pecorino romano.
Very
usually.
Light.
Little oregano.
Cheese. Huh.
And garlic. And that's it.
And Michael, when Michael says a flat bread, it's a pizza crust. It's not
really like, flat.
It's
and
not
thin.
A panini or something.
And best of all, as made in New Haven, it's that kind of Neapolitan style where the edge of the crust kind of puffs up and gets slightly blistered black in places. And the underside has little bits of burnt semolina on the bottom. It's really just one of the great eating experiences ever.
Ah, you're bringing back my Jersey Shore days, guys. Thanks.
You got to come out here, Lynn.
You know, you're right. Good to talk to you both.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest work is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, their finds are on the site, splendidtable.org. So we talked pizza, which made me think of pie, like peach pie with the juices bubbling up and getting brown and sticky. Well, when I say pie, it means crust, and you stop in your tracks because you say, that's hard, I can't make crust. Stay with me. Crust can be easy. It's one formula and three tips. That is it. So here's the formula. You are going to need for crust butter, flour, salt, and sugar. Now, for a 9 to 10 inch pie, you want to put in a bowl or in a food processor one stick of stone cold butter that you've cut in big chunks, 1 1/4 cups flour, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and a tablespoon of sugar. Now, mix that all together with your hands or with the machine until it's lumpy, okay? It should look like big, big peas. Now you need something wet, 4 to 5 tablespoons of ice water and 1 tablespoon of vinegar. That's for tenderness. Now for your first trick. Do not overmix. Toss together the wet and dry stuff with a fork or pulse with the processor. You want it clumpy. You don't want it to look like cookie dough. It should look really rough. And the way you know that you've got enough moisture is you're going to squeeze some of the dough together, and if it sticks together, it's right. Tip 2, chill, chill, and chill some more. Every time you handle the dough, whether it's to mix it or to roll it, chill it. That's how it gets tender. Tip 3, never let the dough get warm unless it's in the oven. So that's it. One formula, 3 tips, and you've got pie crust. Now, to make pie, you don't even need a pie pan. You could use a skillet or any flat metal surface like the upside-down roasting pan you have, or maybe a cookie sheet. Roll out the dough, pile on lots of fruit in the center, flip the dough from the sides over the fruit, and bake. And you've got pie. Now, I'm putting the crust formula on the website, splendidtable.org, and then you can take off. Coming up, Feasting with Mark Twain, and wait until you hear
what keeps our lunch company in that office refrigerator. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Halley's Comet appears every 75 years. It used to be a big deal before we got blasé about this kind of thing. But it was a magical thing when it showed up in 1835. And with it came a pretty magical person, Samuel Clemens. He was born then. His pen name was Mark Twain. The next swing of the fireball saw his passing in 1910. In fact, he actually predicted that. In between, Twain became America's voice, its beloved storyteller and satirist. Well, now writer Andrew Bear has discovered another side of Twain, one to warm the hearts of we food lovers. Bear's written Twain's Feast, searching for America's lost foods in the footsteps of Samuel Clemens. Andrew Bear, it's good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
What do you see as Twain's place in American literature?
Well, I think he's probably best known today as the author of Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn and other novels that were kind of among the first to make great use of the common speech of everyday American life. But in his lifetime, he was probably better known as a travel writer. His first account of traveling to Europe, The Innocents Abroad, was actually his best-selling book in his lifetime. Travel writers at the time were among the people that helped Americans to understand what the rest of the world was and what their place was in it. And that's how Twain came to write the menu that sparked the writing of Twain's Feast.
I think you better explain that.
Well, in 1878 and 1879, Twain traveled with his family back to Europe, and he was going to write a follow-up to The Innocents Abroad, this time called A Tramp Abroad.
Right.
And after traveling around the continent for a year, he was desperately homesick and had been limited the whole time to eating in European hotels where he absolutely detested the food. And so just before returning home, he sat down and wrote a fantasy menu of all of his favorite American dishes, the things that he looked forward to eating again and said that he wanted waiting on the dock when he got home off the steamboat.
What were they?
Well, it ranged all over. There was produce like butter beans, asparagus, green corn cut from the ear and served with butter and pepper. There were regional dishes like Southern-style apple puffs, fried chicken, early rose potatoes roasted in the ashes Southern-style, served hot, sliced tomatoes with sugar or vinegar, stewed tomatoes, oysters roasted in shell Northern-style. soft-shell crabs, Connecticut shad, Baltimore perch. He went on and on in this vein for pages.
Oh. Obviously, this man just loved to eat.
Oh, it was really one of his passions. You can see it in just the variety of what he was including. It was produce, baked goods, local dishes of all sorts. But the most specific foods were all wild things. He talked about not just steamed mussels, but mussels from San Francisco. Not just trout or even lake trout, but it was lake trout from Tahoe. So that was what really sparked my interest in the menu, was seeing why was he so exact about wild foods and what was he thinking of when he wrote these down.
Had he known those foods personally? I mean, had he traveled that much in the United States?
Absolutely. Yeah, he had traveled all over the country. He was a riverboat pilot for a period before the Civil War and had traveled all up
name,
and down.
That's where he got his name, wasn't it, Mark Twain?
That's exactly right. They would call out Mark Twain to say that the water is 2 fathoms deep and therefore it's clear sailing. Or it could be getting more dangerous if it's getting more shallow.
Uh-huh.
But he'd gone up and down the Mississippi. He'd been west to Nevada, which was Washoe at the time, and San Francisco and east to Philadelphia. And that's when he tasted all of these foods, and that's why he insisted on being so exact, that he knew the places that these foods came from and cared about the places.
The food writing of his that you quote, I mean, if he were writing today, he would have one heck of a career and he would be mopping up the awards right and left.
That's absolutely true. He was somebody who had passionate joys and passionate angers at the same time.
Is there anyone today that has Twain sensibilities?
Well, I think it's a sensibility that's very relevant today. One of the things that really struck me in writing this is that words like fresh and local, these are not modern catchphrases. This has been the basis for the best American cooking for a very long time. And I think that those standards that Twain acquired, that's something that more and more people are dedicated to rediscovering and to preserving in America.
He was so lusty about it. You have to love the guy.
You do.
Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Behrs is author of Twain's Feast. Now, let's not buy into the hogwash that American food was despicable until some moment of blinding enlightenment in the 1970s. Now, to prove my point, try my recipe for an old-fashioned favorite, stirred lemon ice cream with fresh cherries. You're going to find it on the website, splendidtable.org, and I would not be surprised to learn that it was one of Twain's favorites. Once again, gardeners and farmers are asking themselves, what was I thinking? As they gaze out over their crop of the most unloved squash, zucchini. There's always more than anybody wants. But then again, there are believers like Dina Pritchett.
Making fun of zucchini is almost a cliche. People talk about growing zucchinis the size of baseball bats and joke about sneaking them into unlocked cars. At least, I thought it was a joke.
We would actually take extra zucchinis to friends' houses, at least they started as friends, and leave them on the doorstep and ring the doorbell and run away.
That's Sarah Dahl illustrating zucchini's bad reputation. But as a zucchini lover, I wanted to redeem it. So I invited a dozen or so guests over for dinner. But not just any dinner.
Zucchini and corn and avocado salad.
Oh, zucchini pickles.
It's a zucchini thing. Kind of afraid of.
Zucchini cupcakes.
Yummy zucchini. It's great. As you may have guessed, this was the all-zucchini dinner party. Now, some of my guests came with their guard up. Like Sarah, Ken and Michael both grew up in the Midwest, and they've both had to deal with zucchini that got out of hand.
I do think it's completely cruel that the bigger they get, the less and less tasty they are. It's a cruel twist of nature.
You grew them, you put all this work into them, and you want to do something with them, so you're trying to figure out something to do with this kind of bitter, kind of mealy, kind of flavorless, sort of soggy, over-the-hill zucchinis. Which these are not, actually. These are really fantastic.
Good save, good save. Even if you do harvest before they reach epic size, you're still left with a lot of zucchini. Mara describes the inevitable result.
Too much of it and I get tired of it. I sort of hit a saturation point sometimes. I'm not there. This is awesome, but I hit saturation.
And then there's the taste. For some, like Seth, it's kind of hard to get behind.
You're basically operating with a handicap. You can cook a steak and, you don't need to know anything and it's delicious. The less you do, the better. But zucchini, you really have to work with. I think it's a difficult vegetable to deal with.
But according to some chefs, that's the wrong way to think. Robert Reynolds teaches cooking here in Portland and wants to set the record straight.
There is no problem with the zucchini. If there's a problem, it might be with somebody else, but the thing itself does not come with the problem. I think it's perfect.
Reynolds says that the subtle flavor is actually an asset.
You know, it lends itself to a million things. The Italians and the French share a pursuit of perfection, and they would pick up the zucchini and look at it and say, God made you perfect, now what can you become?
He has a point. An all-broccoli dinner party could get pretty tiresome by the second course. But zucchini's subtlety lets you push it in dozens of directions. It can become anything. And at this party, it became everything. Pickles for Bloody Marys, pancakes with feta and scallions, a grilled salad with avocado and pickled onions, and a Middle Eastern braise. And of course, cupcakes. As you can probably tell, all it takes is a few bites. To be fair, some people were on Team Zucchini from the start. But even the haters, like Michael, came around. As his wife Cassina noted, he really came around.
He has licked his plate, and I'm going to use that against him.
It seems safe to say that nobody at this dinner party will be leaving zucchini on the doorstep.
So prolific.
Dina Pritchip is a writer and producer in Portland, Oregon. Now, you can check out the photos and Dina's blog on the site, and you can use up a lot of zucchini with the recipe for sweet and hot curried zucchini pickles. And you're going to love having these babies around. Find it all, you know where, the website, splendidtable.org. It's no surprise with the present economy that 70% of us are bringing our lunch to work. Ah, but do you know what's keeping your lunch company in your office fridge? Eric Spitznagel does. He's a reporter with Bloomberg Businessweek. Eric, thanks for talking with us. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Eric, whatever motivated you to do this story?
Well, I was kind of looking at my own refrigerator, and my wife was saying, you know, I think there's certain things in there that have been there since shortly after we got married, and we've been married about 10 years now. And you know, hearing friends who work in offices and hearing all their horror stories made me think there might be something larger happening here with a lot of people dealing with this problem, especially now in the recession with so many people, you know, brown bagging it. You know, they're not going out to lunch as often, so that office refrigerator is overpacked.
That's a good point. All right, but this is the thing. In most companies, aren't the cleaning people cleaning out the refrigerator?
Actually not. I talked to a couple people in New York who own cleaning services, and they both said it's extra, that they'll do the exteriors of everything, but the interior of something like an office refrigerator, you're on your own. They don't even want to look in there unless they're wearing a hazmat suit.
Is it that bad? Because, I mean, people use these things every day. They've got to be aware, and they have to figure out, better do something about this because it's revolting, right?
That's true. But everybody uses this in the office, and that may be part of the problem. I mean, in my own refrigerator, I don't even know half of what's in there in some of these containers. And when you're sharing a fridge with maybe 15, 20 coworkers, everyone passes the buck, and they're like, I'm not opening that. God knows what's going on in there. It could have its own heartbeat at this point. I'm not throwing it out.
But one of the things you mentioned is you asked people about why they don't want to throw things out.
Yes.
And my favorite was, for sentimental reasons? What in heaven's name is that about?
Well, if your mother makes you something, or your girlfriend or husband, you know, makes you something and you bring it into work, you feel like, oh, that's my family. That's something special that I have to hold on to, like it's a memento. But it's a memento that eventually will send you to the hospital.
Yes, exactly. All right, so, okay, let's get practical. First of all, what foods generally spoil quickly and should you really be aware of that you don't want to leave them around?
What I have heard is anything milk-based or yogurt or anything of the kind of dairy family, it will go bad almost instantly. And certainly meats and seafoods, for the love of God, don't leave seafood in there. That just, the very idea of it, I'm getting a little queasy right now.
All right, yeah, okay. That. I mean, we don't have to be too graphic, but it's all right. Animal protein of any kind is a pretty much of a guarantee. All right, now let's talk solutions, all right?
Absolutely.
You interviewed a lot of people. Are there solutions out there? Have some people found the great secret of keeping the thing clean?
Yes. It kind of boils down to having a hard and fast rule. Come Friday, if it's still in there, it's going to be thrown out. Because honestly, in most offices, the refrigerator isn't cleaned that often. In fact, according to one study I found, 44% of office refrigerators are cleaned only once a month. And 22 of them are cleaned only once or twice a year.
Ooh.
So when you break it down like that, you're talking, you have a better chance actually of leaving your lunch in the office bathroom, like store it in the urinal. That's cleaned more often.
Oh, Eric. Oh, Lord.
It is. If you think about the bathroom, everyone expects that to be cleaned. They bring people in there. They scrub it down. But
that's
that
right.
office
that's
refrigerator
true.
Goes for months. So.
I understand. So, okay, Friday, everything goes.
no matter
throw
what.
It out with throw extreme out. Prejudice.
Okay. All right.
Another interesting possibility that came up is there's this designer in New York, Spencer Shamil, I think it is.
Uh-huh.
He's created something called the flip stacking office fridge, which is basically like a Lego style stack of mini refrigerators. So everyone in the office essentially has their own refrigerator, and you take responsibility for it, and it's not a shared space. And that kind of, you know, people are a little bit more motivated to clean it if it's, you know, what smells like sweet death? Oh, that's my refrigerator. They might actually mm-hmm. get in there mm-hmm. with a hose and take care of it.
One-time investment, but could save an awful lot.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, I'm curious about something. Do fights ever break out in offices when the refrigerator's cleaned out and then people lecture each other, you know,
yes.
about this, you know, you're filthy or you have bad habits?
Weirdly, it's the other way around, that people, when they clean out the refrigerator, some of their coworkers get angry because, you know, what happened to my pasta salad? You threw it out. Well, it was starting to look like a cadaver. That's why we threw it out, and it was for your own good. But people get very defensive and upset when their lousy, rotting food, when their mm-hmm. botulism in a bowl gets thrown out.
I guess when it's dated 2008, you may want to get rid of it.
I think that's a good rule of thumb.
All right. Now that we've revolted just about every listener, I want to thank you, Eric. You've done a public service.
Well,
I
thank you. It's my pleasure.
You take care. Eric Spitznagel reports for Bloomberg Businessweek. And by the way, Eric also said that there is a lab in Denmark working on a refrigerator that records what you put in and emails you when it's hitting its expiration date. Which brings us to our weekly trivia challenge, which has nothing to do with the refrigerator devastation, but does have to do with this being pickling season. So the question is, what did Cleopatra do with pickles? I'll be back with that answer in a moment. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or call us 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what did Cleopatra do with pickles? Well, they were her beauty secret. She claimed that her allure came from eating pickles. On the macho side, you've got pickles and war. Julius Caesar passed out pickles to his troops because he knew that they upped physical and spiritual strength. Napoleon's need for pickles for his troops led to the discovery of modern canning techniques. And to top it all off, in 1985, the youngest man to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel did it in, you know what, a pickle barrel. Well, now, this comes from the pickle timeline, and I am not kidding about this. It's on the New York Food Museum website. Now, you can get in on the act with a super simple recipe for icebox pickles inspired by Lois Lee. And that one's on the website, splendidtable.org. Can reach us. The lines are open. Call us, 800-537-5252. Send an email, splendidtable.org, or go to Facebook. Angelina is on the line from Grovertown, Indiana. Angelina, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about basil.
Oh, yes.
My situation is that we've always had a tremendous amount of herbs in our herb garden. We're big gardeners. This year, my husband developed a passion for basil. And so we have 27 wonderfully producing basil plants. But outside of doing the pesto, bruschetta, putting them on salads, grilling them on tomatoes, freezing them and drying them, I don't want to let another leaf go to waste. I'm at a stump on what else I might do, especially if I can preserve them for future use.
Yeah.
If you had any ideas that what I could use them with that I could continue to enjoy them for the rest of the year.
Well, I think freezing is your best bet. And I don't know if you've frozen herbs
before,
right?
I've done the freezing in the ice cubes. I've dried them in my dehydrator. But
oh,
I'm
don't
saying...
do the ice cubes. Oh, no. Don't do the ice cubes. I mean, it's watering them down. All you do is wash them, mm-hmm. let them drain so they, you know, get the leaves are pretty dry.
Mm-hmm.
And then strip the leaves and put them in a bag, in a heavy plastic bag that you can seal all the air out of. You know, write the date and whatever, and then stick them in the freezer. And then you break off what you need.
Which I do, but I'm trying to find other dishes that I could make ahead of time that I could utilize the basil.
All right. Well, one dish that comes to mind, or one technique that comes to mind, Thai food has quite a few recipes where handfuls of basil go into a dish. And a basic idea would be that you could do the simplest of curry paste, which could be the fresh basil with ginger and garlic and chilies. And then that would be sauteed in some sort of oil. It might be, you know, coconut oil. It might be a vegetable oil. You wouldn't want olive oil. You would want an oil that was pretty neutral. And you would slowly saute. And then as it starts to get really, really aromatic, you would add a little bit of coconut milk to that.
Okay.
And then if you want onion, you could have shallots in there. You could have carrots or sweet potatoes.
Mm.
Do you like chilies? Do you like heat?
Love them.
Ah, then you're going to put a lot of chilies in that original mix.
We have probably 12 different species of hot peppers growing right now.
Oh, I wish you guys lived next door.
We do a lot with hot.
This is great. Okay, and you know, with Thai food, you can go as hot as you want. So the idea here is, and by the way, a bit of tomato in that mixture is really, really great. So you're cooking this in a bit of coconut milk, not a lot. It's in a shallow skillet, and you're going to simmer it until the oils actually start to separate so that that basil and curry mixture with those vegetables are in now this slightly oily, really intensely flavored sauce. And then you add to that cut up chicken thighs or chicken breast, or you could add chunks of beef or pork. I like the idea of chicken because you can cook in it about 15 or 20 minutes and it's done. But you can add whatever you want to that. You could just make it all vegetables. And that freezes beautifully. It is utterly delicious. And sometimes people have it just at room temperature, not stone cold because the fat gets hard. And you can get rid of some of that fat. But you have that at room temperature with some extra fresh chopped chilies on top of it.
Oh, yeah.
And then another big handful of the chopped fresh basil.
Wonderful.
And you put that over sticky rice and you are in heaven.
That sounds like it. I'm ready to try it tonight.
And there's lots of variations on that theme.
Okay.
Where the basil is used by the handful and you will just love it. So give it a shot.
I will do that.
Okay.
Thanks so much. Have a great day. Bye.
Take care. Bye. This is something a lot of people don't realize that, you know, if you add basil at the beginning of cooking, you get it as sort of a backdrop. But then add the fresh basil at the end of cooking again, and you get this bright, fresh note. So you get two different effects or two different tastes of the basil. It's a great way to do it. Call us, 800-537-5252. Online, splendidtable.org. Shoot us an email or check us out on Facebook. Brian's calling from Olympia, Washington. Brian, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, Lynn.
Oh, Brian.
Hello. I'm so glad to be able to talk to you.
What's wrong?
Oh, I'm, do you ever feel like you're butting your head against a wall with your partner?
Yeah, I should admit this, but yes.
Well, yeah. My family are foodies from way back. We love food. I buy cookbooks instead of magazines. They decorate my bedside table.
Yeah.
My partner doesn't like to eat and is the pickiest eater I've ever come across. And I'm at a loss for words and deed because I cannot find very many things I can cook for him that he will eat. He likes Greek food.
Well,
very, very safe Greek food. He likes German food.
Okay.
And really bare bones meat and potatoes.
Okay.
But beyond that, I don't know what to cook for him.
Oh, boy. Well, I don't mean to be unkind or too personal, but how did you two get together?
We have other things in common.
obviously. And I don't want to suggest anything that would be detrimental to the relationship. But my heart goes out to you. I feel your pain.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think, I mean, there are people who just don't care about what they eat or don't get pleasure out of food. That's hard to change. But I wonder if he could be brought along just very gently. For instance, he likes very safe Greek food. Well, there's so much, you know, there's realms of Greek food right now, and especially we're in the midst of a whole trend of really looking at Greek food with new eyes. And, you know, there's a lot of the quote-unquote new Greek cooking around, but also reviving older dishes. And I'm just thinking, you know, there are these wonderful meatballs that are sometimes done, and they have within the meatball perhaps nuts or a bit of raisin, certainly parsley and a tad of garlic. And they're cooked in a delicious tomato sauce that has a hint of cinnamon in it. And maybe this kind of thing that you do first, extremely quiet in terms. No, but I mean, you know, that for you it may be a little dull, but for him it may open up. Ooh, I like a meatball in tomato sauce, and it's Greek. You know what I'm saying? And you finish it with a little fresh lemon. There's a chef, Michael, I'm going to mispronounce this, I think it's Patsalis. He has a restaurant in New York called Molivos, and he has done a cookbook. The food is this beautiful combination at the restaurant of traditional and delicious and also lighter, newer. Another author who does great classical Greek cooking that you may want to look at, and you'll just enjoy reading her, and her books are beautiful, is Aglaia Kremidze. So I guess what I'm saying is let's take a cuisine that has a lot of possibilities of fresh and interesting and intricate flavors that you can very quietly ease him into.
I will definitely try that.
And tell him how much you love the fact that he is so, so patient with you.
Yes. It goes both ways.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, the mashed potatoes with that meat, a little basil in there, you know, is that the kind of thing that puts him off?
No, he likes to bake, so he has that baker's mentality.
He likes to bake?
He loves to bake.
Introduce him to the idea of herbed biscuits with little bits of cooked bacon and dashes of cheddar. And then show them what happens when you do a little chicken in a fabulous white wine sauce and you open it up like shortcake and you put that chicken in there. Or you just...
Oh, that sounds good. That might work.
Brian, I wish you luck.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are very welcome.
Take care.
Bye. You can call us, 800-537-5252, or check us out on Facebook and, of course, online, splendidtable.org. Christian is on the phone from Charlotte, North Carolina. Christian, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. So I have a question about tomatoes.
I will babble onward for hours on tomatoes, so you better be really specific.
Okay. So my wife and I have a small garden in our backyard with about 6 or 7 tomato plants.
Right.
We have a few Romas and a few yellows and 1 or 2 traditional just round tomato plants. After moving to the South a few years ago, we learned that the growing season goes pretty late, and our tomato plants keep producing fruit up until the first frost, which sometimes can be in the middle or end of October.
This is a great sacrifice. I can understand this. Yes. Oh, boy, do I envy you. Go ahead.
So by the time November comes around, we usually have maybe about 30 green tomatoes that never really ripen and just sit in a bowl on our kitchen counter. Now, I know that there's the southern dish of frying green tomatoes,
right,
but I'm wondering if there's any other ideas you might suggest, because we just hate throwing all of those into the compost pile.
That would be a mortal sin, although, gosh, the compost pile would really benefit. Well, first of all, you know, if you cover them with newspaper, supposedly you hold in the gases that they naturally throw off. There should be air circulating around them, like, you know, in a basket or something, but they will ripen. But I don't know that they ever get to taste the way they would have tasted straight off the vine.
Right.
But fried green tomatoes notwithstanding, which are fabulous, green tomatoes are a whole different delicacy for a lot of the world. I mean, give you an instance. In the Mediterranean, they're great salad tomatoes. I mean, a green salad with this tart, really crunchy accent. I know in Italy and France, there's actually a term, salad tomatoes, which are underripe tomatoes.
Okay.
So you've got that option. The other and just one basic thing about green tomatoes, because I love them, but I learned the hard way. When you cook them, either cook them all the way to cook them down like making a jam, okay? Or if you cook them with a lot of sugar or a fair amount of sugar as though you were baking them in a pie, because you can bake them in a pie. But don't partially cook them. They just get kind of slimy and unattractive. They're either raw or really cooked.
Okay.
Anything you can do with an apple in a dessert, you can do with a green tomato.
Mm.
All right. Green tomatoes in chutneys are incredible. Now, this could literally be a green tomato cut up into little bite-sized pieces with some onion and some garlic. And if you like fresh ginger, which is just wonderful with them, and you would toss that with salt, pepper, and sugar and vinegar. Do that to taste. And let it sit for 10 minutes. And you put that on a sandwich along with, you know, cold chicken or grilled vegetables, and you'll be in heaven. You can serve that next to, you know, any kind of stew. And you can keep it in the fridge for maybe a week. So that basic idea. Raw, fast, it's a salsa, it's a chutney, etc. The other thing is green tomatoes and yogurt with some pureed cucumber, chunks of green tomatoes here, onion, mint, and garlic, and add a little water and you have a Middle Eastern soup.
Mm. Well, that sounds great.
Yeah, and then you can do a green tomato curry where you make a basic curry base with coconut milk and all kinds of exotic spices, and then the last minute you put in the green tomatoes.
Okay.
And green tomatoes over pasta with ricotta is just fabulous.
Mm. Great. Well, thanks a lot.
You are welcome. You're going to run out of green tomatoes. You're not going to have enough of them.
Okay.
You take care. Thanks, Christian.
Thanks.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Go online, splendidtable.org, or check us out on Facebook. We've got Michelle on the line from New Orleans. Michelle, hi. What's up?
Hi. How are you?
I am good.
Well, I was calling because I'm planning my wedding for October, and I'm thinking of doing seasoned salt in test tubes as my wedding favors, and I was looking for interesting ideas to do the seasoned salt that would be self-stable and attractive.
Yeah, and nobody can mess it up.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's see now. Well, first of all, it's very simple to do. Get some coarse sea salt, and often it's called selgris, G-R-I-S.
Okay.
And you can buy it by the pound, and it's generally a lot cheaper than the very fancy sea salts. And the idea would be that you then just pack it with whatever herbs you want. So a classic combination, if you're looking at an Italian kind of thing, would be perhaps rosemary and some lemon zest, you see.
Okay.
Grated lemon zest in there.
Okay, and that would be shelf-stable?
Oh, absolutely, because the idea is you're going to have more salt than herbs and lemon. And salt's a preservative. Now, another combination, if you wanted to go in a different direction, you could do some sort of hot chili, dry chili with it, mm-hmm. and perhaps even grated ginger, because the ginger, even though it's a fresh product, it's going to be permeated by the salt.
Okay.
So, and I'm just trying to think, one of the lovely combinations is something like dill with nutmeg and black pepper and a lot of salt.
That's different. I've never heard of anything like that.
That's more your Scandinavian angle.
Okay.
And that's wonderful rubbed on fish or on a simple piece of pork that you're going to roast. It's a lovely combination because you know how sweet dill can be, and then black pepper has that kind of spark to it. It's really delicious. You know, I'm just thinking, I've got a bunch of salts that were given to me. Someone's grandmother in Italy used these, and she had marked the bottles for meat, for fish. She did a combination of thyme and basil and I think oregano that was really good. Here's the trick. Look at recipes you really like and look at the herb combinations in them.
Our theme is kind of herbs, so I'm using sage in my bouquets and decorations. So I was thinking of using sage, but some of the recipes I had seen were for frying the sage before.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Oh, no, you're on the right track. Your instincts are right on. Sage, orange zest. Fabulous. Just okay. Fabulous. The combination is a winner all the time. No, you just use fresh sage. You got to fry sage when you're going to eat it on its own. But you don't have to fry right. sage to mix it up with salt. So okay. So tell me, what's he like?
Well, he's a cook, actually. And he loves Cajun. We live in New Orleans, so we're into the pork and Cajun food. So
he cooks in a restaurant?
Yes, he does.
Ah, well, congratulations to both of you. And I think these favors are a great idea because people will really use them and they'll be remembering. Oh, you know what? One last thing. You know, herbs all have meaning.
Right.
And there's a great tradition of brides giving their guests rosemary because rosemary is the herb of fond remembrance. So
okay. I couldn't remember what the significance of rosemary was, but I knew that there was something to that.
Yeah. Yeah,
so I like that a lot.
Yeah, and so you could just do rosemary in different combinations. Or take a sprig of rosemary and with a piece of twine, just attach it, a little couple of sprigs, to each one of those test tubes. Wouldn't that be nice?
I love that idea.
It's so romantic, isn't it? I mean, and so simple.
Hey, yeah.
May it be a joyous day and a great life.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take
care.
Enjoy your show. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. Remember, you can reach us any way you want. Join us on Facebook, check us out on Twitter, or actually go to the phone, 800-537-5252. You have a good week, and until next time, let me leave you with this from Andreas Lurch, who said, "Nothing is what it seems." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Check out our new series of podcasts, The Key Three, interviews with chefs and good cooks about the three recipes they think every cook should know. And take a look at our summertime grilling guide, 40 recipes to get you cooking outside this summer. All the information is, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Chris Peters and Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.